this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, Her Obsession Could Be Art's Savior. Decades ago, art conservationist Adele DeCruz set out to develop a new, minimally invasive technique of restoring priceless works of art. Today, she is a pioneer in the field of laser technology, and as a result, major galleries around the world have their eyes on the preservation work being done at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And that's the headline on the cover. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Tech meets art. Adele DeCruz is shaking up the art world with laser-based conservation techniques. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. On the other side of a heavy metal doorway, tucked behind musty storage space at the North Carolina Museum of Art, three conservators sit, tools in hand. Paintings conservator Noel Ocon's brush passes over a giant wooden panel, a cracked biblical scene that has been untouched for centuries. Perry Hurt, associate conservator of paintings at NCMA, holds what looks like a thin tube attached to a metal box, a laser, etching at an enormous Dutch portrait. And Bill Brown, NCMA's chief conservator, is doing the math in his head, pen in hand, on how to stretch the $20,000 state allocation, coupled with donations, to clean and restore the pieces budgeted to be viewed in the pristine galleries above the ceiling. It's another day at the North Carolina Museum of Art, where conservators in this lab marry decades of artistic know-how with chemistry and physics. The paintings in the collection have been altered over the centuries, explains Ocon, recalling a time when she found a head that had been painted over, floating bodiless in the sky behind layers of blue pigment. It's a high-stakes game, where a wobbly hand could, quite literally, blot out the face of a saint on a priceless altarpiece. Restoring artwork is a responsibility they take seriously, Ocon says. It's our history, she says, pointing to the old adage that, if you don't recall history, you're doomed to repeat it. Paintings are the closest evidence mankind has of what happened in centuries past, she says. But in a world where art can take a budgetary backseat, it's hard for most institutions to invest the funds necessary to protect that legacy, Brown says. NCMA, however, isn't most institutions, evidenced by the $35,000 laser in Hurt's hand. Its proximity to Duke University and to Research Triangle Park Innovation gives it an opportunity to be a prototype organization, with museums such as the National Gallery and the Tate Gallery in London watching what's happening inside these walls. It all started with a laser, a lecture hall, and an ambitious 66-year-old artist with the mind of a scientist who, for decades after she got started, is still innovating. A tale of two passions. Adele DeCruz always knew she would be an artist. She'd dabbed with oil paints in her youth, crafting huge color fields, mesmerized by the brush on the canvas, the colors and the pigment. Today, she looks less like an artist, working out of a cluttered lab down a maze-like hallway in the aging biology building at Duke University in Durham, while the worn leather paint bag bearing the airline tracking label of her most recent trip to New York, scattered brushes, solvents, and aged art pieces offer clues. It's hard to notice them past the giant metal cart attached to the tube she's expertly guiding over a carbon surface. As the needle-like device with the pulsing light moves across the page, a white line forms. She wipes it away. That's all there is to it, she says. The laser, that's what the bulky device houses, retails for upwards of $85,000 and is similar to what you'd find in an ophthalmologist's surgical suite. But this laser isn't searing into your cornea. It's intended to clean the uncleanable, valuable art pieces with centuries worth of varnishes, overpaints, and glazes that obstruct the original painting. And DeCruz is the artistic collaborator responsible for introducing this laser to the art world. While in graduate school, learning the intricacies of centuries-old paintings, she came upon a lecture at Dominican University in Florence, Italy, in the 1970s. It was there, when a professor introduced lasers to his classroom, that DeCruz, the artist, decided to add science to her repertoire. the magic device. The first laser had been built more than a decade earlier at a laboratory in California. Scientists from the West Coast were looking at ways to apply their bulky, mysterious technology to multiple industries. And Italy, a country ripe with art history, seemed like a good setting to introduce it to the art world. De Cruz can't quite put her finger on what drew her to the massive devices and the scientists creating them back in the 1970s, but she does say she knew that it was the technology of the future. "I was sure of it," she says. "The lasers then were powerful, too powerful. The heat generated by the pulse could and would burn through a canvas." Although De Cruz can't recall a specific instance where an artifact was defaced, if one of the old lasers were in her lab today, it would sear and smoke its way through the carbon paper and likely into the counter beneath. In the early 70s, researchers were using them to remove black crust that had settled over the centuries onto marble in Florence and Venice. When it came to paintings, they were using a variety of harsh solvents that made for dangerous work, she says, recalling the stressful experience of chemically removing layers from a 16th century Venetian panel that had been completely overpainted in the 17th century. The wrong chemical combination could do more than erase the varnish. It could permanently disfigure a masterpiece worth millions. While some applauded the new technology as a magic trick, a novelty, De Cruz obsessively researched the physics of the devices, the way the light worked, the way it could interact with a surface, and the way it could take the stress out of cleaning precious artwork. In those days, it wasn't portable. Her colleagues, when experimenting, had to bring the artifacts to the laser, moving the test piece back and forth against the stationary, sizzling light. It wasn't until the late 70s when the object her team moved to the laser became a painting. It was a mock-up, a small piece where De Cruz herself painted over the work, letting it dry and harden for several months. Her team was able to ablate, she never uses words like etch or remove, the paint without burning a hole through the canvas. "We got the results, but the technology, the laser, was enormous," she says. "It was hot." The challenges were obvious. First, she'd have to cool the temperature, something she accomplished over the decades, teaming up with physicists and chemists. They settled on a wavelength discovered in the 1980s and soon applied to eye surgery, a wavelength that, when a surface was kept wet, could be kept to 10 degrees Celsius. Second, she'd have to have something portable, something she could use for delicate, controlled work. Donning the cloak of science. It would be two decades before De Cruz was ready to use the device on a painting. In between, she found herself in a variety of places. From California, where she learned the physics of the lasers from the early innovators, to Raleigh in 1979, where her first professional role as conservator would put her in charge of the lab at North Carolina Museum of Art. Throughout her career as conservator and academic in Italy, California, and North Carolina, the lasers never left her mind. She was constantly collaborating, reaching out to scientists across the country who had the engineering know-how to test her theories. The breakthrough may have been the introduction to the Duke University professor she calls a laser pioneer, Myron Wolbarscht, who researched ways the technology could be used in ophthalmology. Their first conversations could have been patentable, she recalls with a smile. In 1997, a prototype was ready for an actual painting. It was a panel painting, tempera on wood, from 15th century Italy. And there were questions as to its authenticity, because thick shellac coated the surface, a frequent trait of counterfeit pieces. The tempera paint was so thin that a solvent would deface the entire piece. "With the laser, we could loosen the surface," she says, and beneath the layers of shine, she discovered real gold, highlighting its hidden value, the first of many mysteries she'd solve by pressing light to an artifact. But the art world was still skeptical. She recalls the words of a colleague after a presentation she gave at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. "You know, Adele, it's a very steep learning curve." But Brown had the opposite reaction when he attended a lecture De Cruz was giving at Duke. That was the beginning of a really terrific collaboration that we have between Duke and NCMA, she says. Today, it's a precise science, and one Ocon and Hurt use frequently in their lab at NCMA, where the technology had its first real museum debut. Larry Wheeler, director of the museum, says it's an invaluable collaboration and one that's worth even more investment. "We're becoming more and more of a laboratory," he says. "Other museums are looking to us for new models, and they're looking to the success of our experiments." And the laser, dubbed the Conservator, is just one of the ongoing experiments happening through the Duke collaboration. Building a better laser. DeCruz's colleague, Warren Warren, a biomedical imaging professor at Duke, was taking a stroll through the National Gallery in London decades ago while on a break from a scientific conference when he happened upon an exhibit on how researchers detect art forgeries. "I realized they were using 30- or 40-year-old technologies," he says. At the time, researchers would use a scalpel, literally cutting into a masterpiece, taking a minuscule chip of paint to examine under a microscope. Warren had been developing a technology of his own, a laser, to study skin cancer. "We wondered if that same technology that lets you look deeper below the surface would also help you understand some things about artwork," he says. He made his own connections, cold calling Brown at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Brown was all too excited to hear what Warren had to say. Called pump probe lasers, they create three-dimensional cross-sections of the art. The method made its debut at the NCMA with Crucifixion, a 14th century piece by Puccio Capanna. The laser revealed a layer of lapis lazuli, a material that at the time was more expensive than gold, telling researchers that it was a more important piece than they'd previously realized. Innovation with imaging. One new preservation technique is coming out of a triangle company. Optical coherence tomography, OCT, is an imaging system much like ultrasound that uses light instead of sound to produce an image of delicate tissue. It's intended for ophthalmologists so they can see the delicate structures inside a child's eye. Lasers of the retina or the cornea, explains Eric Buckland, CEO of Bioptigen, a Morrisville-based company that developed what he calls the first FDA-approved OCT device. But what's under varnish, like what's behind your pupils, can be tough to discern. Layers of material, painted on over hundreds of years, are hard to separate visually, even for experienced conservators. DeCruz had been watching what Bioptigen and companies like it have been developing. A few months ago, she contacted Buckland's team, curious about how the OCT would enhance her understanding of painting construction. Buckland says an initial test involved a 150-year-old Venetian painting, and it appeared to be a success. Preparations are now underway to collaborate further with masterpieces in the NCMA's collection. The goal is to create a roadmap, visualize the layers in a piece so that conservators can tell where the masterpieces end and the additions begin. Lisa Microsystems, the microscope company that acquired Bioptigen in July, has worked with art museums before. Its equipment is in institutions across the country. But this is a first for Buckland, the holder of 25 scientific patents and graduate degrees in physics and optics. While applying the device to the art world doesn't really cost his team anything but time, he has no illusions of profit potential in this arena for his $85,000 and up imaging device. "It's not going to be our number one market," he says, "but this will give us the insights we need to determine whether this is a viable application for our technology. And sometimes things are fun, and this is fun." DeCruz says it's ultimately about preservation of history and culture. "Once a generation passes and everyone's dead, you can't recreate what they created," she says. "All you can do is preserve it." And associated with the article, there's a section called How It Works. It's nearly impossible to know how many times a centuries-old painting has been touched. Sometimes it's shellac, thick and thin layers of shiny varnish meant to protect the piece. Other times it's overpaint, hardened over decades, obscuring what the artist initially ascribed to the panel. That's where conservators come in with their tools, everything from solvents to paintbrushes to, with the introduction of a Duke University-developed device, a laser. The laser releases a pulse, which introduces a phase change from liquid to gas, penetrating between 3 and 5 microns into the surface of a piece. For a conservator, it's simpler than it sounds. She can move the laser applicator by hand, targeting a layer thinner than the thinnest scalpel cut. Conservators, who know what they're doing, the crew says, can now become trained on the device in fewer than 10 days. It's a painstaking process that takes several hours, days, or even months for a large-scale portrait, but it and other cleaning techniques are why you're able to enjoy dozens of galleries at the North Carolina Museum of Art, says director Larry Wheeler. Some museums don't get it right, he says. You can always tell. After a painting is cleaned, conservators, such as Okun, can apply their own overpaint, correcting parts of the visual narrative that may have been irrevocably altered or scraped away over the years. The materials on her brush are frequently different than what came from the original artist's hand, as some of the pigments used in ancient artifacts are impossible to replicate today, such as ground-up mummy pigment and the then-popular shade of yellow that, centuries ago, came from the urine of cows that were only fed mangoes. There's a synthetic alternative that does the trick today. Everything that's added in the lab is documented and is removable in case future conservators need to revisit the masterpiece. And there's another related section called Bringing Art to Life with Technology, and it lists different steps in the process. The laser, purchased for what Brown calls a highly discounted $35,000, it helps conservators ablate layers of varnish, revealing the restored artifacts underneath. It debuted at the museum in 2014 and is the brainchild of Adele DeCruz. The Pump Probe. The Pump Probe laser imaging technique comes from Warren Warren, a chemistry professor at Duke who initially created it to diagnose melanoma. It helps conservators recognize which materials were used when the piece was created centuries ago, sorting out the overpaint from the original painting. Instead of using a scalpel to remove tiny samples of pigments, a method that can damage the painting, conservators can get a three-dimensional view without having to chip the surface. OCT. OCT, or Optical Coherence Tomography, is early in its applications at NCMA. Bioptigen, a Morrisville-based medical device company, has created an OCT imaging tool intended to help ophthalmologists see delicate structures in the eye. And researchers at Duke think that same technology will help them distinguish between layers of varnish and paint in centuries-old pieces. They'll start bringing pieces to the device for experimentation this month. X-ray radiography. By analyzing pieces in the X-ray radiography lab, conservators at NCMA can make discoveries about a painting's manufacturing process and condition. And they don't just scan paintings. Researchers use the scanner to view artifacts from the Queen Anne's Revenge shipwreck site. And computer imaging. Computer software is among NCMA's most valuable tools. A recently developed paint shop plugin dubbed Platypus, created through the collaboration with Duke, allows conservators to remove a lattice pattern from an image. Conservators used to do what's called cradling, a practice where they'd attach wooden slats to the back of old paintings to prevent warping. But the lattices are hard to remove and obstruct images, distracting researchers from analyzing the paint layers. The plugin eliminates that pattern from view. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The Triangle loves its country music. Biz hears there are a lot of things up in the air for the Garth Brooks Show during the March 11 through 12 weekend at the PNC Arena. For one, no one knows how many shows will be performed by Brooks. It all depends on the demand. If the first two shows sell out, Brooks will add a third one. If the third one sells out, Brooks could add a fourth one. With all tickets priced at $74.98 apiece, it would be interesting to see the real demand for a Brooks concert in Raleigh after 18 years. Country music star Alan Jackson has teamed up with Cary-based building supply company Plygem to launch a new campaign to raise money and awareness for Habitat for Humanity's building efforts in 2016. Plygem, for its part, will be donating more than $1 million of exterior building products to help build more than 300 Habitat homes throughout the year. As ambassador for Habitat's Home for Good project, Jackson will promote the initiative via social media and other promotionals using his recent hit single, You Can Always Come Home. Good works, not wonks, are focus of new Duke podcast. A small team at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy has launched a podcast about public policy targeted toward people who care about creating a better world, and the word wonk is nowhere to be found. We wanted to bring the power of narrative to policy and politics and show how solving public problems is first and foremost about people, says Karen Kemp, co-producer. The Ways and Means audio show launched last week on iTunes and Stitcher. It's a show for people curious about the best ideas for improving our society. Each episode combines personal stories and pioneering public policy research to explore how and why society works, how it could work better, and why our best ideas sometimes fail, according to Sanford. New episodes of Ways and Means will premiere monthly. Execs cheer when Heels top Terps in ACC Big Ten game. It looked like a good portion of the Triangle business community was at the December 1 basketball game between number 9 UNC and number 2 Maryland at the Dean Smith Center. Biz was there as well for the late-night ACC Big Ten Challenge encounter, which ended with a Tar Heel victory and a whole lot of happy executives. Spotted in the crowd were PNC Bank's regional head Jim Hansen, Gale Force Holdings President Don Waddle, MERS Vice President Michael McMain, and Plexus Capital co-founder Kel Landis, among many others. On the court, the Heels recognized the work of a couple of its former stars, James Michael McAdoo and Harrison Barnes, for their roles in winning the 2015 NBA championships for the Golden State Warriors. Also spotted sitting beside the Maryland bench was former Terrapin coach Gary Williams, who seemed to have a stoic face for most of the night. For the record, UNC won 89-81. Calliope goes down under on Bronto's city tour. Months after his Durham-based email marketing venture was acquired by NetSuite for $200 million, Bronto Software CEO Joe Calliope has kept busy. He tells Biz he just got back from Australia, the last leg of Bronto's 2015 city tour, a trek that included stops in London, New York, Los Angeles, and Sydney, all between September and mid-November. While most of his trip down under was in Sydney, he did get to enjoy the Australian summer with a trip to the Blue Mountains, and yes, he saw kangaroos and koalas. Local retailer lands on Oprah's favorite things list. Apex-based specialty retailer Moon and Lola, with 5 locations in the Triangle, has landed in Oprah Winfrey's annual Favorite Things gift guide created for O, the Oprah magazine. It's the second year Oprah has chosen the company for the guide. Last year, Moon and Lola's monogrammed cufflinks were featured. This year, it's a customizable monogrammed pet ornament. The problem with the dog lovers on your list? They've already got lots of cute framed photos of their furry friends, says Winfrey. But do they have a mirrored gold ornament in the shape of their pet, engraved with his name? Didn't think so. I have a few people in mind who would love this. And finally, a section called You Said It. Readers respond to TBJ survey question, what would you change about downtown Durham? More parking garages? Get rid of the loop one-way streets? Holiday window shop decorations? Get rid of the railroad tracks that divide downtown and make them walking, biking corridors? More loft condo options? More retail shops, more ethnic, authentic food options. Add white lights to all the downtown trees year-round. More street festivals and events. Add more trees and water features to the landscape. clean it up and get rid of vagrants. Better parking signage. Pave the streets. Downtown Durham roads are bad. Add a grocery store. Install a tramway. Many of the buildings are just plain ugly and need to be torn down and replaced. Improve nighttime street lighting. Reduce the crime. Move it to Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBruin. The headline, Gilad's Hep C drugs cause NC's Medicaid bill to soar. North Carolina's Medicaid program has seen payments for hepatitis C treatments balloon in recent years, due largely to the cost of two drugs made by Gilad Sciences. In fiscal year 2015, which ended June 30, North Carolina Medicaid paid $61 million for hepatitis C treatments. That figure is more than double spent in 2014, nearly six times spent in 2013, and 15 times what Medicaid spent in 2011, according to data provided by North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. The increased costs are due largely to two new drugs, Sovaldi and Harvoni, made by Gilad Sciences. In the past 2 years, Medicaid has spent a combined $63 million on those two drugs alone. The California-based drug maker has received some criticism for the high price of the drugs, which run as high as $94,500 for a 12-week treatment of Harvoni. In 2014, Gilad Sciences recorded $10.3 billion in sales from Sovaldi. Through the first three quarters of 2015, Gilad Sciences recorded $10.5 billion in sales of Harvoni. Others have pointed out that the drugs cure a patient from hepatitis C, making them cheaper than a lifetime worth of steady drug regimens. Furthermore, an article in the journal Health Affairs points out that the costs for hepatitis C drugs make up just a fraction of overall drug spending in the United States, a figure that will soon top $400 billion, and makes up 10% of all health spending. The conflict between prices and innovation is unlikely to resolve quickly, according to the Health Affairs authors. As consumers shoulder more of the cost of their prescription medications, there will be more pressure on insurance companies to negotiate lower prices. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "The reaction from doctors has been, 'Thank you, someone is finally telling me something that I don't already know.'" And that quote is from Michael Cousins, CEO and founder of Durham-based Forecast Health, which raised $1.5 million from private investors and will now begin to market itself as a company that can bring better predictive analysis to healthcare organizations. And in a section called Big Numbers, the number is $73,296. Average annual wages plus benefits for the 260 jobs that Premier Research will add in a Durham expansion. The England-based contract research organization will expand operations in Durham and also has research hub operations in Boston, Chicago, and Hartford, Connecticut. An economic development incentive package with a jobs development investment grant worth $2.5 million over 12 years was approved for Premier Research by the state-appointed Economic Investment Committee under guidance from the Commerce Department. And Durham's Bioventus acquires California biotech firm. Durham-based Bioventus acquired California-based BioStructures, a maker of bioreabsorbable bone graft products. The agreement includes the entire BioStructures portfolio of products, as well as its research and development pipeline. Financial specifics of the deal were not released. BioInventus is approximately a $260 million annual business, and BioStructures, through the third quarter, has revenue of just more than $9 million. BioInventus was spun out of Smith & Nephew and has been a standalone entity since May 2012. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. Mammoth Ag Science Center coming to RTP. Nowadays, the campus at 5 Davis Drive is mostly unoccupied. But the top executives of the company that bought the property for $20 million in 2013 are about to pull the trigger on a plan that, in one decade's time, could transform the property into a sprawling urban research campus with thousands of employees working at big-name biotech brands. Joel Marcus, CEO of Alexandria Real Estate Equities, says to expect the new RTP cluster to be called the Alexandria Center for Science, Technology, and Agriculture, to be similar to what his company has already done in places such as Cambridge, Massachusetts, Mission Bay, California, and Manhattan, New York. It will be like a mini-city, he says. The 150,000-square-foot building already at the site will be refurbished, laying the groundwork for further development to include offices, laboratories, and accelerator space. Alexandria Venture Investments, the firm's venture capital arm, intends to invest in what's called the MedBlue Incubator, which was founded in 2013 to identify promising new science and technology coming out of the departments of surgery, pathology, and anesthesiology at Duke University Medical Center. Additionally, ARE is opening what's called Alexandria Launch Labs at the campus, taking over an accelerator Hamner Institute already operates at the facility, complete with 9 startups, including the recently acquired Foundry Pharmaceuticals. Alexandria Venture Investments and Accelerator Corporation, a biotechnology investment and management company, will be establishing a venture investment and technology scouting presence within Launch Labs in RTP, and additional startup space is part of the plan. Our venture arm will be very active down there, Marcus predicts. We think this whole effort will be really catalytic. And its proximity to another bullish real estate project, Research Triangle Foundation's newly acquired Park Center, adds to the appeal. Park Center will bring retail, residential, and restaurant elements to RTP. Millennials want a place where they can live, work, and play, he says, and they're about to get it. NCSU researchers discover process for creating real diamonds. It took 3 decades, but at a lab at NC State University's Centennial Campus, a group of researchers say they've created something that sounds like it belongs in an alien treasure chest, glow-in-the-dark diamonds. The material is a newly discovered state of solid carbon, dubbed Q-carbon. It's complicated research, admits Jay Narayan, director of the National Science Foundation Center for Advanced Materials and Smart Structures at NCSU, but he says it's groundbreaking. To convert carbon into diamonds is a dream of all scientists all over the world, he says. The scientific world has actually known how to create jewels for some time. At extremely high pressures and temperatures, think thousands of kelvins, carbon can be compressed into a glittering diamond. But unless you're Superman, it's an expensive, complicated, low-yield process. Until now. Using kinetics, he says he's done it. His team uses quick-moving, high-powered lasers, the same devices used in laser eye surgery. Researchers hit carbon with a single laser pulse that lasts about 200 nanoseconds, raising the temperature to 4,000 degrees Kelvin. The cooling happens so rapidly that you'll never know it was hot, creating a film of Q-carbon. We can scale up easily because these lasers are just really, really fast, he says. The initial goal will be to create nano needles for drug delivery, diamond coatings for polishing, and diamonds for thin film electronics. Eventually, he and his team want to grow diamonds large enough for jewelry, but testing nano applications comes first, he says. We want to see if we can compete, he explains, although he does say the process could create a 1-carat jewel in about 20 minutes. Patents have been filed, and one partnership has been inked with wearable device maker Coppin Corporation out of Boston. Since the final product appears to glow in the dark, it has the potential to make very efficient display devices, he says. But crazy ideas, too, are already pouring in, like calls he's getting about turning cremated human ashes into diamonds. Right now, I'm more interested in the commercial applications, he tells the callers. His research has been supported by Coppin, as well as a $500,000 grant from NSF. But now that the breakthrough has happened, he's expecting the dollars to increase. No one has done this, he says. Our process is ready. The process works very neatly. It's just a matter of putting together a business plan. The state of carbon, he's discovered, doesn't exist in known nature. The only place it may be found in the natural world would be possibly in the core of some planets, he says. It's been Narayan's mission for more than 3 decades to create diamonds at normal atmospheric conditions. In fact, Narayan first published a paper on the concept in 1979. And in a section called Timeline, it's been a year of exits at American Tobacco Campus, a space that used to be occupied by tobacco warehouses. Today, it's occupied by innovation. Since January, 6 companies have met with high-profile exits within its borders. Michael Goodman, Vice President of Real Estate at ATC Parent Capital Broadcasting, says there's no special sauce. I think we've been really lucky in finding some great partners at American Tobacco and people who have really decided to call downtown Durham an American Tobacco home. February, Automated Insights, an artificial intelligence platform that writes quick narratives for the Associated Press, was bought out by Vista Equity Partners owned Stats. In March, Appia, an app marketing platform, was bought out by Digital Turbine in a $100 million stock and debt deal. In April, Two Toasters, an app design and development agency, was bought out by Ticketmaster, a division of Live Nation Entertainment. And in April, email marketer Bronto Software was bought out by NetSuite in a $200 million deal. October, venture-focused bank Square One was bought out by PacWest Bank in a deal valued at about $849 million. And in October, open-source IT automation startup Ansible was bought out by Red Hat. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We felt that the kind of tech environment and the tech culture in downtown Durham is pretty close to what we're used to here in downtown Charlottesville, Virginia. It's a dense and growing area with lots of alternative music, lots of alternative lifestyles, and that tends to breed a pretty high-tech culture, a designed-focused culture, which is what we look for in our team." And that's from Tobias Dangle, CEO of Virginia app developer WillowTree, which is bringing 98 new jobs to Durham in exchange for state and local incentives. And in a section called She Said It, the quote, "Based on the information available to Lenovo after conducting a review, Lenovo is unaware of any improper inducements or benefits that influence Lenovo sales to Union County Public Schools." And that quote is from Malanka Muke, Lenovo spokesperson, on an investigation into whether Union County school officials profited from school contracts for computers. The State Bureau of Investigation is conducting an official inquiry into the matter. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. Offers for historic homes come in higher than expected. State inks deals to sell Person Street properties. 4 of the 6 historic homes that the North Carolina state government is seeking to sell along Person Street in downtown Raleigh have so far received buyer offers that range as high as 29% above the list price. All of the buildings are former residences built in the early 1900s and converted to office space for state government workers decades ago. Several were moved from their original locations in the Blount Street Historic District a few years ago to make way for future redevelopment programs, or plans, excuse me. Each house, however, is in serious need of rehabilitation after years of neglect and deferred maintenance, and each is being sold by the state as is, meaning that a buyer shouldn't expect the state to repair even a nail hole in the walls. The Council of State at its monthly meeting on December 1 approved the sale of 5 of the 6 buildings, including the Lamar House at 401 North Person Street, originally listed for $415,000. An offer was submitted by Matthew M. Brown for $536,000, 29% above the list price. The Ashley House at 219 East North Street, originally listed for $435,000. An offer was submitted by TLC Francis, LLC, and its managing member, Charles T. Francis, for $500,500, 15% above list price. The Watson House at 411 North Person Street, originally listed for $285,000. An offer was submitted by Thomas Jefferson Porter and his wife, Judith A.L. Porter, of Wilmington for $291,600, 2% above list price. The Gay House at 419 North Person Street, originally listed for $275,000. A matching offer was submitted by Kimberly A. Wagner and Robert Frank Wagner for $275,000. And the Worth House at 415 North Person Street, originally listed for $255,000. An offer was submitted by Darcia Black for $245,100, 4% below list price. A sixth state-owned property in the group, the Cambridge House at 407 North Person Street, has also been listed for $405,000, but the state property office is still negotiating offers for its sale. Two tech companies relocating to former Lighting Incorporated building in downtown Raleigh. Big changes have been happening over the past year and a half at the headquarters for one of Raleigh's fastest-growing technology companies, SpectraForce Technologies. And now the founders of the company have decided to uproot their staff in the Raleigh suburbs and move downtown. SpectraForce co-founder Madhu Madugu says that since starting a second company in 2013, the robotics recruiting software firm LeoForce, he's been looking at options to grow and improve both companies' recruiting efforts. "We needed to have a more vibrant working environment, and downtown usually can offer those options to help us attract good talent," Modugu says. The two companies have signed a lease to take over all of the 13,200-square-foot former Lighting Incorporated retail building at the corner of Peace and West Streets in downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District, and Modugu says they are hoping to be moved in by late February 2016. SpectraForce was founded in 2004 by both Modugu and CEO Amit Singh. The company has grown to employ about 1,500 people, offering IT outsourcing and staffing services. The company has been a regular on Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 list. The company peaked at number 3 on the Fast 50 list in 2011. Most of its employees, though, are based at offshore delivery centers in India. In Raleigh, SpectraForce and LeoForce together have about 50 people working out of their current offices at the Capital Center Office Park in West Raleigh. Modugu says the building on Peace Street will be completely different from the traditional office space the companies have occupied for years, and it will be an expansion of what the companies currently occupy in West Raleigh. Family-owned Lighting Incorporated operated a retail and repair shop that sold new and refurbished lighting fixtures at the site for 60 years. That company relocated to another location in North Raleigh in October after the complex of properties at Peace and West Streets was sold to the Lundy Group of Raleigh for $1.4 million. John Keener of the Lundy Group says they have reached agreements with other nearby property owners to make sure that SpectraForce and LeoForce will have enough parking for the employees. The Capital Grill restaurant coming to North Hills. The Capital Grill, one of the top-ranked steakhouse restaurants in the U.S., has inked a deal to open one of its newest locations in the new 18-story Bank of America Tower at North Hills in Raleigh. The restaurant is projected to open in summer 2016. It's second in North Carolina, upon completion of the office tower at the corner of Six Forks and Dartmouth Roads. The Capital Grill also has a location in Uptown Charlotte. Avaya leaving RTP, lease in Durham. Avaya, the business communications company that took over a large part of bankrupt Nortel Networks' remaining operations in Research Triangle Park in 2009, will soon be moving those operations outside of RTP, but staying inside the Triangle. Avaya has signed a new long-term lease contract to move into about 43,500 square feet next summer at the Meridian Office Park building in Durham at 2605 Meridian Parkway. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the first column is written by Karen Kerrigan, who is president and CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council in Washington, D.C. The headline on her Viewpoint column: very little doubt that time to reform USPS has come. Recent news reports reveal that the U.S. Postal Service is inept and ill-equipped for modern times. The Government Accountability Office discovered that the USPS largely fails to track whether mail is delivered on time, forgoing oversight of nearly half of all the material it handles. Add to this the ongoing and well-publicized financial problems at the USPS. A new study by the Tax Foundation found the USPS, United States Postal Service, last earned a profit in 2006, and since then has lost more than $7 billion per year. In the first half of 2015, it has already lost $2.8 billion. The future of the USPS certainly looks bleak. The Cato Institute to the Washington Post now share a similar observation. Perhaps it is time to privatize the USPS. Indeed, the challenges and possible solutions at the USPS are as grand and diverse as the clientele it serves. This means focusing on areas impacting small businesses, which drive new job creation, innovation, and growth. For example, analyzing the Postal Service's international operations is an important area for review. The USPS provides more favorable rates to foreign businesses shipping to U.S. customers than American businesses shipping to a domestic customer just one state over. Shipping a 100-gram package to a neighboring state, for example, costs $1.94 to travel a distance of less than 350 miles, while a company in Shanghai would pay $1.12 to send the same package to the same address in the U.S. at a distance of more than 7,000 miles. How can it cost less to ship a package a longer distance? At a recent congressional hearing on international postal rates, the USPS Inspector General said, "We lose revenue on every single package we deliver," referring to international packages. According to the Inspector General, the USPS lost $79 million on international shipments in 2013 and a total of $308 million since 2010. So why does the USPS keep doing this? The clear losers are American businesses selling to American consumers, and these are many of the sellers through our website, said Paul Meisner, Vice President of Global Public Policy at e-commerce giant Amazon. The clear winners are foreign sellers selling to American consumers. They get a terrific benefit. Yet the USPS maintains this revenue-losing and inequitable practice. The USPS, which is supported by $18 billion in annual subsidies from the federal government, red taxpayers, needs to work for the American people and businesses first. The USPS's newest campaign says, "Watch us deliver." Small businesses are watching and waiting for reforms that require the USPS to run like a business and treat us equitably in the global marketplace. And the other Viewpoint column is written by Robert Orr, who served on the North Carolina Supreme Court from 1994 to 2004. Prior to that, he served 8 years on the North Carolina Court of Appeals. And the headline of his Viewpoint column: bond passage vital to education economy. On March 15, 2016, voters across North Carolina will be going to the polls, casting primary ballots in their respective parties, but also deciding the fate of our state's future and well-being with a $2 billion bond package for our university system, our community colleges, our state parks, our National Guard, and numerous local water and sewer system improvements. As an avid supporter of our state park system and former Associate Justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, I was honored to be asked by the governor to co-chair the Connect NC Bond Committee. The Connect NC Bond Plan is designed to bring together our state's greatest assets and strengthen them so we can continue to be the best place to live, work, and play. The $2 billion bond package will provide targeted long-term improvements focused on critical areas that will improve our quality of life. For example, the $980 million dedicated for our university system will help prepare our students for the future through construction of new science and technology buildings on campuses across the state. Our community college system will receive $350 million for new construction and repairs that will enable the local education centers to improve their mission to train our state's workforce. The bonds will benefit agriculture across the state by providing $179 million for agricultural research facilities, including a new plant sciences building at NC State University, and a new science lab for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, which will be dedicated for veterinary research and a food and drug testing laboratory. Our state parks will also benefit from the bond, with $75 million dedicated to facility improvements for park facilities from Mount Mitchell to Fort Fisher. The North Carolina Zoo will receive $75 million for a new exhibit center. At the local level, there is $309 million dedicated to help county and municipal governments fund critical improvements to their water and sewer systems, helping retain and recruit new industries and commerce to our state. Finally, there will be $70 million dedicated to pay for new National Guard training facilities across the state. The North Carolina National Guard is our first defense and our saving grace in times of natural disasters and state emergencies. Their need is critical to support their mission to protect the homeland. Let's face it, the bonds will provide a critical facelift for our state, providing long-term infrastructure and facilities that will benefit North Carolinians for generations. Historically, North Carolina has always supported infrastructure investments because we know the return on investments brings a better quality of life. Our schools, our businesses, our communities, and our citizens all benefit. The Connect NC bond plan will not raise taxes. This will be the first state bond referendum since 2000. In fact, we are paying off state debt ahead of schedule and have the capacity to repay the bonds without any additional tax revenue needed from our citizens. We could not ask for a better time to borrow money. Interest rates on government-backed bonds are at a historic low, and that will be a great benefit to our Treasury and our citizens, allowing us to maximize the value of the bonds by putting money into vital projects, not into high interest rates. Throughout our history, the state's finances have been managed prudently. We have protected our AAA credit rating, and these bonds will not threaten those ratings. State Treasurer Janet Cowell and State Budget Director Lee Roberts have provided critical guidance and input on the bonds and are supporting the bond referendum. So the bond campaign is off and running. It is a bipartisan team of government officials, university and business leaders, farmers and foresters, and regular everyday citizens. We are working together to build a better North Carolina, to connect our people and our assets for tomorrow and future generations. This important investment in education, agriculture, our state parks, and our National Guard will help ensure that North Carolina will maintain its place as a leader in innovation, job creation, economic development, and our quality of life. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page, and we look at the spotlight that is on Rob Madry, Director for Sustainability at the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. After 15 years working in the marketing and development departments at the North Carolina Symphony, and ultimately serving as an assistant vice president at the organization, Rob Madry has now been tapped to lead the sustainability efforts at the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. In his new role at NCCN, Madry is responsible for securing the financial resources from corporations, businesses, and foundations across the state. With nearly 1,600 nonprofit members, the NC Center for Nonprofits bills itself as a statewide network for nonprofit board and staff members, an information center on effective practices in governing and managing nonprofits, and an advocate for the nonprofit sector. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That being a fundraiser is really about connecting ideas with the interests and passions of donors who believe in our cause of strong and effective nonprofits. What are some of your major goals for your new position? To start forming new and renewed relationships with our many loyal and generous corporate and foundation sustainers, I want to have conversations with them about economic and policy issues that are important to North Carolina's nonprofit sector and seek opportunities for supporting solutions. Biggest pet peeve? Cilantro. Biggest worry? Getting clobbered in the traffic on Wake Forest Road at the Beltline. Triangle business person you most admire? Steve Schuster, a principal at Clearscapes. Personal, Madry is married to Mark Talbert, associate director of NC State Live. Last book you've read? Switch, How to Change Things When Change is Hard, by Dan Heath and Chip Heath. And this issue of the Triangle Business Journal also included a special section on the Healthiest Employers of the Triangle 2015 Awards, and we'll read off that list of the healthiest employers winners. Baker Roofing, Biogen, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, Capital Broadcasting Company, Elliott Davis to Cosimo, Fidelity Investments, Hill, Chesson & Woody, Lord Corporation, Mulkey Engineers and Consultants, Parada Systems, PPD, Rail Link, Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, Red Hat, Schemetrica, Store Office Environments, Syngenta Crop Protection, and eight others round out the list, but we'll have to stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.